She emptied the wardrobes of the house, taking the children's clothes, the blankets from the beds, her husband's jackets. She packed up food from the pantry and establishing a shipping system with Pedro Segundo Garcia, who sent cheese, eggs, smoked meat, fruit, and chicken from Tres Marias for her to distribute among the poor. She lost weight and looked emaciated. She began to walk in her sleep again. Ferula's absence was a cataclysm in the house. Even Nana, who had always wished for this moment, was upset. When spring came and Clara was able to get some rest, her tendency to escape reality and lose herself in daydreams became more pronounced. Even though she could no longer rely on her sister-in-law's impeccable skills for ordering the chaos of the big house on the corner, she still paid no attention to domestic matters. She left everything in the hands of Nana and the other servants, and immersed herself in the world of apparitions and psychic experiments. Her notebooks that bore witness to life grew confused, and her calligraphy lost its convent elegance, degenerating into a series of mangled scribbles that were sometimes so tiny they were impossible to read, and sometimes so large that three words would fill a page. In the years that followed, a group of Gurdjieff students, Rosicrucian spiritualists, and sleepless bohemians gathered around Clara and the three Mora sisters. They ate three meals a day in the house and spent their time alternating between urgent consultations with the spirits of the three-legged table and reading the verses of the latest mystic poet to land in Clara's lap. Esteban allowed this invasion of grotesqueries because he had long ago realized that it was pointless to interfere in his wife's life. But he was determined that at least his sons would be kept at a safe distance from her magic. So Jaime and Nicolas were sent to a Victorian English boarding school where any excuse sufficed for pulling down a student's pants and caning his buttocks. This happened especially to Jaime, who made fun of the British royal family and at the age of 12 displayed an interest in reading Marx, a Jew who was spreading revolution around the world. Nicolas inherited the adventurous spirit of his great-uncle Marcos and his mother's propensity for making up astrological charts and reading the future. But this did not constitute a major crime in the rigid code of the school, only an eccentricity. So he fared far better there than his brother. Blanca's case was a different matter because her father did not interfere with her education. He believed that her destiny was marriage and a brilliant life in society, where the ability to converse with the dead, if kept on a frivolous level, could be an asset. He maintained that magic, like cooking and religion, was a particularly feminine affair. For this reason, perhaps, he was able to feel a certain sympathy for the three Mora sisters, while he despised male spiritualists almost as much as he did priests. As for Clara, she went everywhere with her daughter hanging from her skirts. She included her in the Friday sessions and raised her in the greatest intimacy with spirits, with the members of secret societies, and with the impoverished artists whose patroness she was. Just as she had gone with her mother in the days when she was mute, she now took Blanca with her on her visits to the poor, weighed down with gifts and comfort. "This is to assuage our conscience, darling," she would explain to Blanca. "But it doesn't help the poor. They don't need charity. They need justice." This was the point on which she had her worst arguments with Esteban, who was of a different opinion on the subject. "Justice? Is it just for everyone to have the same amount? The lazy, the same as those who work? The foolish, the same as the intelligent? Even animals don't live like that. It's not a matter of rich and poor, it's a matter of strong and weak. I agree that we should all have the same opportunities, but those people don't even try. It's very easy to stretch out your hand and beg for alms, but I believe in effort and reward. Thanks to that, I've been able to achieve what I've achieved. I've never asked anybody for a favor and I've never been dishonest, which goes to prove that anyone can do it. I was destined to be a poor, unhappy notary's assistant. That's why I won't have these Bolshevik ideas brought into my house. Go do your charitable work in the slums for all I care. It's all well and good. Good for building the character of young ladies. But don't start coming in here with the same half-cocked ideas as Pedro Tercero Garcia, because I won't stand for it. It was true that Pedro Tercero Garcia was talking about justice in Tres Marias. He was the only one who dared to speak back to the patrón, despite the beatings his father gave him every time he caught him in the act. Since he was a child, the boy had been making surreptitious journeys into town to borrow books, read the newspapers, and converse with the local schoolteacher, a fervent communist who years later would be shot dead by a bullet between the eyes. He also stole away at night to the bar in San Lucas, where he met with certain union leaders who had a passion for fixing the world's troubles between sips of beer or with the huge, magnificent Father José Dulce María, a Spanish priest with a head full of revolutionary ideas that had earned him the honor of being relegated by the Society of Jesus to that hidden corner of the world, although that didn't keep him from transforming biblical parables into socialist propaganda. The day Esteban Trueba discovered that the son of his administrator was slipping subversive pamphlets to his tenants, he summoned him to his office and, in the presence of his father, gave him a lashing with his snake-skin whip. "This is the first warning, you insolent little shit," he said without raising his voice and staring at him with fire in his eyes. "But the next time I catch you bothering people, I'm going to lock you up. I don't want rebels on my land, you hear? Because I'm the one in charge here, and I have the right to surround myself with people I like. And I don't like you, and now you know it. I put up with you because of your father, who served me faithfully for all these years. But you'd better watch out, because things could turn out very bad for you. Now get out of here." Pedro Tercero Garcia closely resembled his father. He was dark-skinned and had the same hard features that looked as if they had been sculpted in stone, the same big sad eyes and the same dark, stiff hair that stood up like a brush. He had only two loves, his father and the patron's daughter, whom he had loved from the day they slept together, naked beneath the dining room table, back in his early childhood. Nor had Blanca escaped the same fate. Every time she went on vacation to the country and arrived at Tres Marias in the whirl of dust that always preceded the coaches piled high with their chaotic baggage, her heart would pound with impatience and longing, like an African drum. She was always the first to jump down from the carriage and run toward the house, and she always found Pedro Tercero Garcia in the place where they had seen each other for the first time, standing barefoot in the doorway, half hidden by the shadow of the door, timid and sullen in his worn pants, his old man's eye scanning the horizon as he awaited her arrival. The two ran to each other, hugging, kissing, laughing, and affectionately punching each other and rolling on the ground as they pulled each other's hair and shouted with joy. "That's enough, young lady. Let go of that raggedy child," Nana would shriek, trying to pull them apart. "Let them be, Nana," Clara would say, for she knew better. "They're only children, and they like each other." The children ran off to hide and tell each other everything that they had stored up during the long months of separation. Pedro blushingly handed her some whittled animals he had made for her, and Blanca gave him the gifts she had brought for him, a penknife that opened like a flower, a tiny magnet that magically picked up rusty nails from the ground. The summer she arrived with half the contents of the trunk of magic books that had belonged to Uncle Marcos, she was nearly 10 years old. Pedro Tercero still had trouble reading, but his curiosity and desire accomplished what his schoolmistress had been unable to do with all her canings. They spent that summer reading among the rushes by the river, the pine trees in the forest, and the sprouting stalks of the wheat fields, discussing the virtues of Sinbad and Robin Hood, the bad luck of the black pirate, the true and edifying stories from the treasury of youth, the worst meanings of the words that did not appear in the dictionary of the Spanish Royal Academy, the cardiovascular system in illustrated plates where you could see a man with no skin and all his veins and arteries exposed for all to see, but wearing underpants. Within a few weeks, the boy had learned to read voraciously. They entered the wide, deep world of impossible stories, gnomes, fairies, men stranded on islands who eat their comrades after casting their fate at dice, tigers who let themselves be tamed for love, fascinating inventions, geographical and zoological curiosities, oriental countries with genies and bottles, dragons and caves, and princesses held prisoner in towers. They often went to see old Pedro Garcia, whose senses had been worn away by time. He had gradually grown blind. His eyes slowly filled with a sky blue film of which he said, "The clouds are taking over my sight." He was grateful for the visits from Blanca and Pedro, who was his grandson, although he had already forgotten that fact. He listened to the stories they had chosen from the magic books, which they had to shout into his ear, because he also said that the wind was invading his ears and making him deaf. In return, he showed them how to protect themselves from the stings of poisonous insects, and demonstrated the effectiveness of his antidote by placing a live scorpion on his arm. He taught them how to search for water. "You have to hold a dry stick in your two hands and walk tapping the ground. In silence, thinking only of water and the thirst of the stick, until suddenly, sensing the presence of moisture, the stick began to tremble. That's where you have to dig," the old man said. But he explained that this was not the system he used for digging wells around Tres Marias, because he needed no stick. His bones were so thirsty that whenever he walked on top of underground water, no matter how far down, his own skeleton told him where it was. He taught them about the different grasses and herbs that grew in the fields, and made them smell them and taste them, even caress them, until they were able to identify them one by one according to their healing properties. This one to calm the mind, that one to get rid of diabolic influence, this one to make the eyes shine, that one to strengthen the stomach, this to stimulate the flow of blood. In this realm, his knowledge was so vast that the doctor from the nuns' hospital used to come and ask his advice. Nevertheless, all his knowledge was powerless to cure the chicken fever of his daughter, Pancha, which had dispatched her to the hereafter. He had made her eat cow dung, and when that did not produce results, he gave her horse manure, wrapped her in blankets, and made her sweat up her illness until there was nothing left of her but skin and bones. Then he massaged her with brandy and gunpowder, but it was all useless. Pancha's life ebbed away in an interminable case of diarrhea that destroyed her body and left her with an insatiable thirst. Defeated, Pedro Garcia asked the patron for permission to take her into town on a cart. The two children went with them. The doctor in the nuns' hospital carefully examined Pancha and told the old man there was nothing he could do. That if he had brought her earlier and not induced the sweating, he would have been able to treat her. But now her body could hold no liquid. She was just like a plant when its roots have gone completely dry. Pedro Garcia took offense at that and continued to deny his failure even when he returned to the hacienda with his daughter's body wrapped in a blanket, accompanied by the two frightened children, and unloaded her in the courtyard of Tres Marias, grumbling about the doctor's ignorance. They buried her in a special plot in the tiny graveyard alongside the abandoned church, at the foot of the volcano, because she had been the patron's wife, in a manner of speaking, since she had given him the only son who bore his name, though not his surname, and a grandson, the strange Esteban Garcia, who was destined to play a terrible role in the history of the family. One day, the old man, Pedro Garcia, told Blanca and Pedro III the story of the hens who joined forces to confront a fox who came into the chicken coop every night to steal eggs and eat the baby chicks. The hens decided they had had enough of the fox's abuse. They waited for him in a group, and when he entered the chicken coop, they blocked his path, surrounded him, and pecked him half to death before he knew what had happened. And that fox escaped with his tail between his legs, with all the hens chasing after him, the old man finished. Blanca laughed at the story and said it was impossible, because hens are born stupid and weak, and foxes are born astute and strong. But Pedro III did not laugh. He spent the whole evening absorbed in thought, ruminating on the story of the fox and the hens, and perhaps that was the night the boy began to become a man. 5. The Lovers. Blanca's childhood went by without any major surprises. The hot summers at Tres Marias, where she discovered the strength of a love that grew as she did, alternating with the routine of the city, was not unlike that of other girls of her age and class, although Clara's presence added a note of eccentricity to her life. Every morning, Nana would appear with the breakfast tray to shake her from her sleep, watch as she put on her uniform, stretch her socks for her, place her hat just so, help her into the gloves, arrange her handkerchief, and make sure she had all her books, all the while mumbling prayers for the souls of the dead and loudly advising Clara not to be deceived by the nuns. "Those women are all depraved," she warned her. "They choose the prettiest, smartest girls from the best families to be sent to the convent. They shave the heads of the novitiates, poor girls, and set them up for a lifetime of baking cakes and taking care of other people's old folks." The chauffeur took the little girl to school, where the first activity of the day was mass and obligatory communion. Kneeling in her pew, Blanca would inhale the intense smell of the Virgin's incense and lilies, suffering the combined torment of nausea, guilt, and boredom. It was the only thing she disliked about school. She loved the high-vaulted stone corridors, the immaculate cleanliness of the marble floors, the naked white walls, and the iron Christ who stood watch in the vestibule. She was a romantic, sentimental child, with a preference for solitude, few friends, and a propensity to be moved to tears when the roses in the garden bloomed, when she smelled the rags and soap the nuns used as they bent over their tasks, and when she stayed behind to experience the melancholy stillness of the empty classrooms. She was considered timid and morose. Only in the country, her skin tanned by the sun and her belly full of ripe fruit, running through the fields with Pedro III, was she smiling and happy. Her mother said that that was the real Blanca, and that the other one, the one back in the city, was a Blanca in hibernation. Because of the constant agitation that reigned in the big house on the corner, no one, except Nana, noticed that Blanca was becoming a woman. She entered adolescence overnight. She had inherited the Trueba's Spanish and Arab blood, their regal bearing and haughty grin, and the olive skin and the dark eyes of the Mediterranean genes, all colored by her mother's heritage, from which she drew a sweetness no Trueba had ever known. She was a tranquil soul who entertained herself, studied hard, played with her dolls, and showed not the slightest inclination for her mother's spiritualism or her father's fits of rage. The family jokingly said that she was the only normal person for many generations, and it was true, she was a miracle of equilibrium and serenity. At around 13, she began to develop breasts. She lost weight, her waist thinned out, and she shot up like a transplanted tree. Nana pulled her hair back in a bun and took her to buy her first corset, her first pair of silk stockings, her first grown-up dress, and a collection of miniature towels for what she continued to call demonstration. Meanwhile, her mother continued making chairs dance through the house, playing Chopin with the lid of the piano shut, and declaiming the beautiful verses of a young poet she had taken under her wing, a poet who was beginning to be talked about everywhere, never noticing the split seams of the schoolgirl's uniform or seeing that the apple face of her daughter was subtly changing into the face of a grown woman, because Clara paid more attention to auras and fluids than she did to pounds and inches. One day she saw her walk into the sewing room in her party dress and was astonished to discover that that tall, dark lady was her little Blanca. She put her arms around her, covered her with kisses, and warned her that she would soon begin to menstruate. "Sit down and let me tell you what it is," Clara said. "Don't worry, Mama. I've already had it once a month for the past year," her daughter said, laughing. The relationship between them underwent no major changes with the girl's development, because it was based on a solid principle of mutual acceptance and the ability to laugh together at almost everything. That year, summer arrived early, with a sultry heat that covered the city with its nightmare glare. The family decided to advance their departure for Tres Marias by 2 weeks. As always, Blanca eagerly awaited the moment of seeing Pedro III again, and as she had every year, the first thing she did on climbing down from the coach was to run to look for him with her eyes glued to where she knew he would be standing. She saw his hidden shadow in the doorway and jumped from the vehicle, hurtling toward him with the eagerness of all her months of anticipation. But to her surprise, the boy turned on his heel and fled. All that afternoon, Blanca went to each of their special meeting spots, asking for him, shouting his name, even looking for him at the house of old Pedro Garcia, his grandfather. Finally at sundown, she went to bed, defeated, without eating supper. In her huge brass bed, shocked and hurt, she buried her face in the pillow and cried inconsolably. Nana brought her a glass of milk and honey, understanding in a flash the reason for her grief. "It's about time," she said with a twisted smile. "You're too old to be playing with that flea-ridden brat." Half an hour later, her mother came in to kiss her goodnight and found her sobbing the last gasps of a melodramatic sorrow. For a moment, Clara ceased to be a distracted angel and came to stand beside a simple mortal who suffered, at 14, the first torments of love. She wanted to inquire, but Blanca was very proud, or already too much of a woman, and would tell her nothing. So Clara just stood beside her bed and caressed her till she calmed down. That night, Blanca slept fitfully and woke at dawn surrounded by the shadows of her large bedroom. She lay in bed staring up at the coffered ceiling until she heard the first rooster crow. Then she got up, opened the curtains, and let the soft morning light and the first sounds of the world enter the room. She walked over to the mirror on the wardrobe and stared at herself for a long time. She took off her nightgown and, for the first time in her life, looked at her body in detail. And as she did so, she realized that it was because of all these changes that her friend had run away. She smiled a new, delicate smile, the smile of a woman. She put on her old clothes from a preceding summer, which were almost too small, wrapped herself in a shawl, and tiptoed out so as not to wake the rest of the family. Outside, the fields were shaking off their sleep, and the first rays of sunlight were cutting the peaks of the cordillera like the thrusts of a saber, warming up the earth and evaporating the dew into a fine white foam that blurred the edges of things and turned the landscape into an enchanted dream. Blanca set off in the direction of the river. Everything was still quiet. Her footsteps crushed the fallen leaves and the dry branches, producing a light crunching sound, the only noise in that vast sleeping space. She felt that the shaggy meadows, the golden wheat fields, and the far-off purple mountains disappearing in the clear morning sky were part of some ancient memory, something she had seen before exactly like this, as if she had already lived this moment in some previous life. The delicate rain of the night had soaked the earth and trees, and her clothing felt slightly damp, her shoes cold. She inhaled the perfume of the drenched earth, the rotten leaves, and the humus, which awakened an unknown pleasure in all her senses. Blanca arrived at the river and found her childhood friend sitting at the spot where they had met so many times. That year, Pedro III had not grown as much as she had. He was the same thin, dark child as always, with the same protruding belly and the old man's expression in his black eyes. When he saw her, he stood up, and she guessed that she was at least half a head taller than he. They looked at each other disconcertedly, feeling for the first time in their lives that they were practically strangers. For what seemed like an infinite time, they stood immobile, adjusting to the changes and the new distances. But then a sparrow trilled, and everything reverted to the way it had been the preceding summer. Once again, they were two children running, hugging, laughing, falling to the ground and rolling over and over, crashing against the pebbles, murmuring each other's names, elated to be back together. Finally, they calmed down. Her hair was full of dry leaves, which he removed one by one. "Come here, I want to show you something," said Pedro III. He took her by the hand. They walked along savoring that reawakening of the world, dragging their feet through the mud, picking tender green stalks to suck out their sap, looking at each other and smiling, without speaking, until they reached a distant field. The sun was just appearing over the volcano, but the day had not settled in yet, and the earth was still yawning. Pedro told her to throw herself flat on the ground and be very quiet. They crawled along, coming close to some clumps of underbrush, made a short detour, and suddenly Blanca saw it. It was a beautiful bay mare in the process of giving birth alone on the hillside. The children did not move, trying to keep even their breath silent. They watched her pant and push until they saw the colt's head appear and then, after a while, the rest of its body. The little animal fell to the ground and the mother began to lick it, leaving it as clean and shiny as waxed wood, coaxing it with her muzzle to stand up. The colt tried to get up on its feet, but its fragile newborn legs folded under it and it fell down, looking helplessly up at its mother, who neighed a greeting to the morning sun. Blanca felt her breast shoot with joy, and tears came to her eyes. "When I grow up, I'm going to marry you, and we're going to live here in Tres Marias," she whispered. Pedro stared at her with his sad old man's look and shook his head. He was still much more of a child than she, but he already knew his place in the world. He also knew that he would love this girl as long as he lived, that this dawn would live in his memory, and that it would be the last thing he would see before he died. They spent that summer oscillating between childhood, which still held them in its clasp, and their awakening as man and woman. There were times when they ran like little children, stirring up the chickens and exciting the cows, drinking their fill of fresh milk, and winding up with foam mustaches, stealing fresh-baked bread straight from the oven and clambering up trees to build secret houses. At other times, they hid in the forest's thickest, most secret recesses, making beds of leaves and pretending they were married, caressing each other until they fell asleep exhausted. They were still innocent enough to remove their clothes without a trace of curiosity and swim naked in the river, as they always had, diving into the cold water and letting the current pull them down against the shiny stones. But there were certain things they could no longer share. They learned to feel shame in each other's presence. They no longer competed to see who could make the biggest puddle when they urinated, and Blanca did not tell him of the dark matter that stained her underwear once a month. Without anyone telling them, they realized that they could not act so freely in front of others. When Blanca dressed up as a young lady and sat on the terrace sipping lemonade with her family each afternoon, Pedro III would watch her from afar, without coming closer. They began to hide when they wanted to play. They stopped walking hand in hand within sight of the adults. and they ignored each other so as not to attract attention. Nana gave a sigh of relief, but Clara started watching them more carefully. The vacation was over, and the Truebas returned to the city laden with jars of candy, preserves, boxes of fruit, cheese, pickled chicken and rabbit, and baskets full of eggs. While everything was being packed away in the cars that would take them to the train, Blanca and Pedro III hid in the granary to say their goodbyes. In those 3 months, they had come to love each other with the ecstatic passion that would torment them for the rest of their lives. With time, their love became more persistent and invulnerable, but it already had the depth and certainty that characterized it later on. Atop a pile of grain, breathing in the pungent dust of the granary in the diffuse, golden morning light that filtered through the chinks, they kissed, licked, bit, and sucked each other, sobbed and drank each other's tears, swore eternal love, and drew up a secret code that would allow them to communicate during the coming months of separation. Everyone who witnessed the moment agrees that it was almost 8 o'clock at night when Férula appeared without the slightest warning. They all saw her in her starched blouse, with her ring of keys at her waist and her old maid's bun, exactly as they had always seen her in the house. She entered the dining room just as Esteban was beginning to carve the roast, and they recognized her immediately, even though it had been 6 years since they last saw her, and she looked very pale and a great deal older. It was a Saturday, and the twins, Jaime and Nicolás, had come home from school for the weekend, so they too were at the table. Their testimony is very important, because they were the only members of the family who lived completely removed from the three-legged table, protected from magic and spiritualism by their rigid English boarding school. First, they felt a sudden draft in the dining room, and Clara ordered the windows shut because she thought it was the wind. Then they heard the tinkling of the keys, and the door burst open, and Férula appeared, silent and with a distant expression on her face, at the exact same moment that Nana came in from the kitchen carrying the salad platter. Esteban Trueba stopped with a carving knife and fork suspended in midair, paralyzed with surprise, and the three children cried, "Aunt Férula!" almost in unison. Blanca managed to rise to her feet to greet her, but Clara, who was seated beside her, reached out her hand and held her back. Clara was actually the only one to realize on first glance what was going on, despite the fact that nothing in her sister-in-law's appearance in any way betrayed her state. Férula stopped 3 feet from the table, looked at everyone with her empty, indifferent eyes, and advanced toward Clara, who stood up but made no effort to go any closer, and only closing her eyes and breathing rapidly as if she were about to have one of her asthma attacks. Férula approached her, put a hand on each shoulder, and kissed her on the forehead. All that could be heard in the dining room was Clara's labored breathing and the metallic clang of the keys at Férula's waist. After kissing her sister-in-law, Férula walked around her and went out the way she had come in, closing the door gently behind her. The family sat frozen in the dining room, as if they were in the middle of a nightmare. Suddenly, Nana began to shake so hard that the salad spoons fell off the platter. The sound of the silver as it hit the floor made everyone jump. Clara opened her eyes. She was still having difficulty breathing, and tears were running down her cheeks and neck, staining her blouse. "Férula is dead," she announced. Esteban Trueba dropped the carving implements on the tablecloth and ran out of the room and into the street, calling his sister's name into the night. But there was no trace of her. Meanwhile, Clara ordered one of the servants to fetch their coats, and by the time her husband returned, she was halfway into hers and holding the car keys in her hand. "Let's go to Father Antonio," she said. They rode in silence. Esteban was at the wheel. His heart contracted as they searched for Father Antonio's old church in the poor quarters of the city where he hadn't been in years. The priest was sewing a button on his threadbare cassock when they arrived with the news of Ferula's death. "But that's impossible," he exclaimed. "I was with her 2 days ago, and she was in good spirits." "Please, Father, take us to her house," Glada begged. "I know what I'm saying. She's dead." At Glada's insistence, Father Antonio accompanied them. He led Esteban down one narrow street after another until they came to where Ferula lived. Through all those years of solitude, she had lived in one of the tenements where she used to say the rosary against the wishes of its intended beneficiaries in the days of her youth. Esteban had to park the car several blocks away, because the streets had gotten narrower and narrower until there were only bicycles and people on foot. They walked deeper into the neighborhood, avoiding the puddles of dirty water that overflowed from the gutters and dodging the piles of garbage in which cats were digging like silent shadows. The tenement was a long passageway of ruined houses, all exactly the same. Small, impoverished dwellings built of cement, each with a single door and two windows. They were painted in drab colors, and their peeling walls, half eaten by the damp, were linked across the narrow passageway by wires hung from side to side, which by day were used for laundry, but this late at night swung empty in the dark. In the center of the little alley, there was a single fountain, which was the only source of water for all the families who lived there, and only two lanterns lit the way between the houses. Father Antonio greeted an old woman who was standing by the fountain, waiting for her pail to fill with the pathetic output of the faucet. "Have you seen Señorita Ferula?" he asked her.
"She should be in her house, Father. I haven't seen her these past few days," the old woman replied.
Father Antonio pointed to one of the houses. It was just like all the others, sad, flayed, and dirty. But there were two pots hanging by the door in which grew a few small tufts of geraniums, the flower of the poor. The priest knocked at the door.
"Go on in," the old woman shouted from the fountain. "The señorita never locks her door. There's nothing to steal in there anyway."
Esteban Trueba called his sister's name, but he didn't dare go in. Clara was the first one across the threshold. It was dark inside, and they were immediately met by the unmistakable aroma of lavender and lemon. Father Antonio lit a match. The weak flame cut a circle of light in the shadows, but before they could take a single step, the match went out. "Wait here," he said. "I know the house." He groped his way, and a moment later lit a candle. His figure stood out grotesquely, and his face, deformed by the light from below, floated halfway to the ceiling, while his giant shadow danced against the walls. Clara described this scene in her notebooks that bore witness to life in minute detail. The two dark rooms, their walls stained with damp, the small dirty bathroom without running water, the kitchen, in which there were only a few dry crusts of bread and a jar with a little tea in it. The rest of Ferula's quarters seemed to Clara to fit precisely with the nightmare that had begun when her sister-in-law appeared in the dining room of the big house on the corner to say goodbye. It reminded her of a used clothing store or the dressing room of a struggling theater company. Hanging from a few nails on the wall were old dresses, feather boas, squalid bits of fur, imitation rhinestone necklaces, hats that had gone out of style 50 years before, stained petticoats with threadbare lace, dresses that were once flashy and whose sheen had long since disappeared, inexplicable admirals' jackets and bishops' chasubles, all thrown together in grotesque fraternity, in which the dust of years had made its nest. On the floor, there was a jumble of satin shoes, debutantes' handbags, belts studded with fake stones, suspenders, and even the shining sword of a military cadet. She saw dreary wigs, pots of rouge, empty flasks,
and an unruly collection of impossible objects scattered everywhere. A narrow door divided the only two rooms of the house. In the other room, Ferula lay on the bed. Festooned like an Austrian queen, she wore a moth-eaten velvet dress and petticoats of yellow taffeta. On her head, firmly jammed down around her ears, shone the incredible curly wig of an opera star. No one was with her. No one had known she was dying. And they calculated that she must have been dead for many hours because the mice were already beginning to nibble her feet and eat her fingers. She was magnificent in her queenly desolation, and on her face was an expression of sweetness and serenity she never had in her grievous life. She liked to wear used clothing that she bought in second-hand shops or picked from the garbage, explained Father Antonio. She would make herself up and put on these wigs, but she never hurt a fly. On the contrary, until her last, she always said the rosary for the salvation of sinners. "Leave me alone with her," Clara said firmly. The two men went out into the alleyway, where neighbors were beginning to gather. Clara took off her white wool coat and rolled up her sleeves. She went up to her sister-in-law, gently removed the wig, and saw that she was nearly bald, aged, and helpless. She kissed her on the forehead, just as Ferula had kissed her only a few hours earlier in their own dining room, and then she calmly proceeded to improvise the rites of the dead. She undressed her, washed her, meticulously soaping her without missing a single crevice, rubbed her with cologne, dusted her with powder, lovingly brushed her four remaining strands of hair, dressed her in the most eccentric and elegant rags that she could find, and put back her soprano's wig, returning to her in death the infinite attentions that Ferula had given to her in life. While she worked, fighting off her asthma, she told her about Blanca, who was a young lady now, about the twins, about the big house on the corner, and about the country. "And if you only knew how much we missed you, Ferula, how I've needed your help to look after the family. You know I'm no good at domestic matters. The boys are terrible, but Blanca is a lovely child, and the hydrangeas that you planted with your own two hands in Tres Marias turned out beautiful. Some are blue because I put copper coins in the fertilizer. It's a secret of nature. And every time I arrange them in a vase, I think of you. But I also think of you when there aren't any hydrangeas. I always think of you, Ferula. Because the truth is that since you left me, no one has ever loved me as you did." She finished arranging her, stayed a few minutes talking to her and caressing her, and finally called in her husband and Father Antonio to make the burial arrangements. In a cookie tin, they found the unopened envelopes of money Esteban had sent his sister once a month for all those years. Clara gave them to the priest for charitable works, sure that that would be what Ferula would have wanted. The priest stayed with the dead woman so that the mice wouldn't treat her disrespectfully. It was almost midnight when they left. Ferula's neighbors had gathered in the doorway to discuss the news of her death. Esteban and Clara had to make their way through the huddle of curious faces and shoo away the dogs that were sniffing among the crowd. Esteban walked quickly with his big strides, practically dragging Clara behind him without noticing the dirty water that was spattering his impeccable gray trousers from the English tailor. He was furious because his sister, even now that she was dead, could still manage to make him feel guilty, just as she had when he was a boy. He recalled his childhood, when she surrounded him with dark solicitude, wrapping him in debts of gratitude so huge that as long as he lived, he would never be able to pay them back. Once again he felt the sense of indignity that had frequently tormented him when he was with her. He despised her spirit of sacrifice, her severity, her vocation for poverty, and her unshakable chastity, which he felt as a reproach toward his own egotistical, sensual, power-hungry nature. Go to hell, bitch, he thought, refusing to admit even in the farthest corner of his heart that his wife had ceased belonging to him ever since he threw Férula out of his house. Why did she have to live like this when she had more than enough money? Esteban shouted.
Because she didn't have anything else, Clara answered gently.
During the months that they were separated, Blanca and Pedro III exchanged burning letters, which he signed with a woman's name, and which she hid as soon as they arrived. Nana managed to intercept one or two, but she did not know how to read, and even if she had, she would not have been able to break their secret code. Fortunately for her, because her heart would not have withstood the shock. Blanca spent the winter knitting a sweater made of Scottish wool in her sewing class at school, with the boys' measurements in mind. At night, she slept with her arms around the sweater, inhaling the scent of wool and dreaming that it was he who spent the night beside her. Pedro III, meanwhile, spent his winter writing songs on the guitar that he would sing to Blanca, and whittling her likeness on any scrap of wood he could lay his hands on, unable to separate his angelic memories of the girl from the storms that were raging in his blood, turning his bones to pulp, lowering his voice, and causing hair to appear on his face. He was torn between the demands of his body, which was becoming that of a man, and the sweetness of a feeling that was still tinged with the innocent games of childhood. Both young people awaited the coming of summer with aching impatience. When it finally arrived and they met once again, the sweater Blanca had knit for Pedro didn't fit over his head because in the intervening months he had left his childhood behind and acquired the dimensions of a man. And the tender songs he had composed now sounded ridiculous to her because she had a woman's bearing and a woman's needs. Pedro III was still thin and still had his stiff hair and sad eyes, but his voice had acquired a hoarse, passionate timbre that would one day make him famous when he would sing songs of revolution. He seldom spoke and was rough and awkward in his social dealings, but gentle and delicate with his hands. He had the long fingers of an artist, which he used for whittling, for pulling laments from the strings of his guitar, and for drawing, just as easily as he had used them to hold the reins of a horse, or to raise an axe for chopping wood, or to guide a plow. He was the only one in all Tres Marias who dared to confront the patron. His father, Pedro II, told him 1,000 times not to look Esteban in the eye, not to answer back, and not to argue with him, and in his desire to protect him, he had more than once given him a sound beating to knock some sense into his head. But his son was a born rebel. At the age of 10, he already knew as much as his teacher in the school of Tres Marias, and at 12, he insisted on making the trip into town to attend the high school there. Rain or shine, he would leave his small brick house at 5 o'clock in the morning, by horse or on foot. He read and reread 1,000 times the magic books from Uncle Marcos's enchanted trunks and continued to nourish himself with other volumes lent to him by the union organizers at the bar and by Father José Dulce María, who taught him how to cultivate his natural poetic gifts and to translate his ideas into songs. My son, the Holy Church is on the right, but Jesus Christ was always on the left, he would say enigmatically between sips of the wine he used at Mass, which he served to celebrate Pedro's visits. And so it was that one day Esteban Trueba, who was resting on the terrace after lunch, heard the boy sing about a bunch of hens who had organized to defeat a fox. He called him over. I want to hear that, he said. Go on, sing. Pedro III lovingly picked up his guitar, rested his foot on a chair, and began to strum. His eyes did not leave the patron's face, while his velvet voice rose passionately above the soporific air of the siesta. Esteban Trueba was no fool, and immediately understood the defiance. So,
he said. The stupidest things can be set to music. You'd be better off learning love songs.
I like this, patron. In union there is strength, as Father Jose Dulce Maria says. If the hens can overcome the fox, what about human beings?
He picked up his guitar and shuffled out without giving Esteban time to think of anything to say, even though anger had reached his lips and his tension was rising. From that day on, Esteban Trueba kept his eye on him and did not trust him. He tried to prevent him from continuing his schooling, inventing all sorts of tasks for him to do, men's work, but the boy simply rose earlier and went to sleep later in order to finish the work. That was the year Esteban whipped him before his father because he brought the tenants the new ideas that were circulating among the unionists in town. Ideas like Sundays off, a minimum wage, retirement and health plans, maternity leave for women, elections without coercion, and, most serious of all, a peasant organization that would confront the owners. That summer, when Blanca went to spend her vacation at Tres Marias, she almost failed to recognize him. He had grown 6 inches and had left behind the pot-bellied little boy with whom she had spent her childhood summers. She got down from the car, smoothed her skirt, and for the first time in her life did not run to meet him, but simply nodded her head in greeting, although her eyes told him what could not be said in front of everyone. And anyway, she had already told him in her unbridled letters in code. Nana watched it all from the corner of her eye and laughed mockingly. When she walked in front of Pedro III, she sneered at him.
It's time you learn to stay with your own class instead of nosing around señoritas, she said between clenched teeth.
That night, Blanca ate with the rest of the family in the dining room. They were served the chicken casserole that always welcomed them to Tres Marias, and she showed no sign of her usual restlessness during the extended after-dinner conversation, while her father sipped his cognac and talked about imported cows and gold mines. She waited for her mother to signal to her that she was excused. Then she calmly stood up, wished everyone good night, and went to her room. For the first time in her life, she locked it. She sat down on her bed without removing her clothes, and waited in the dark until the twins' raucous shouts in the room next door and the servants' footsteps had subsided, and the doors, the locks, and the whole house had settled into sleep. Then she opened the window and jumped out, falling onto the hydrangea bushes that her Aunt Ferula had planted long ago. It was a clear night, and she could hear the crickets and the frogs. She took a deep breath, and the air brought her the sweet scent of peaches that were drying in the courtyard to be used in preserves. She waited for her eyes to adjust to the darkness, and then began to walk. But she was unable to continue because she heard the furious barking of the guard dogs that were left unleashed at night. They were 4 mastiffs that had been raised tied to chains and spent the daytime locked in a cage. She had never seen them up close, and she was sure they would not recognize her. For a moment, she was swept by panic and about to scream. But then she remembered that old Pedro Garcia had once told her that thieves never wear clothes so dogs will not attack them. Without a moment's hesitation, she pulled off her clothes as fast as she could, threw them over her arm, and continued walking calmly forward, praying that the animals wouldn't smell her fear. She saw them spring forward, barking, and continued without losing rhythm. The dogs came closer, growling with suspicion, but she did not stop. One of them, bolder than the others, came close to sniff her. She felt his warm breath against her back, but she paid no attention. They continued to bark and growl for a long while, accompanied her part of the way, and then, frustrated, went away. Blanca gave a sigh of relief and realized that she was covered with sweat and shaking. She had to lean against a tree and wait until the exhaustion that had turned her knees to jelly passed. Then she quickly put her clothes on and ran toward the river. Pedro III was waiting for her in the place where they had met the summer before, and where, years earlier, Esteban Trueba had stolen Pancha Garcia's humble virginity. When she saw him, Blanca blushed violently. During the months of separation, he had been toughened by the hard job of becoming a man. While she had been shut within the walls of her house and her convent school, preserved from the wear and tear of life and nursing her romantic fantasies while she knit with Scottish wool, but the image of her dreams had nothing to do with this tall young man who was walking toward her, murmuring her name. Pedro III reached out his hand and touched her neck by her ear. Blanca felt something hot run through her bones, loosening her limbs. She closed her eyes and surrendered to it. He pulled her gently toward him and wrapped his arms around her. She pressed her face against the chest of this man she did not know, so different from the scrawny boy with whom she had exchanged such passionate caresses only months before. She inhaled his new scent, rubbed herself against his bristly skin, ran her hands over his lean, strong body, and felt a full, all-encompassing sense of peace that had nothing at all to do with the state of agitation that had taken possession of him. They sought each other with their tongues, as they always did, even though it seemed like a new invention, and fell kneeling as they kissed in desperation. Then they rolled onto the soft bed of damp earth. They were discovering each other for the first time, and there was no need for words. The moon crossed the whole horizon, but they did not see it. They were too busy exploring their deepest intimacy, insatiably entering each other's skins. From that night on, Blanca and Pedro III met every night in the same place at the same time. By day, she embroidered, read, or painted insipid watercolors around the house under Nana's approving glance, now that she could finally sleep in peace. But Clara sensed that something strange was going on, because she could see a new color in her daughter's aura, and she felt sure that she knew why. Pedro III performed his usual tasks in the field and continued to go into town to see his friends. By nightfall, he was dead with fatigue, but the idea of seeing Blanca gave him back his strength. It was not for nothing he was 15 years old. Thus, the summer passed, and years later, they would both recall those passionate nights as the happiest time of their lives. Meanwhile, Jaime and Nicolas used their vacations to do all the things that were forbidden in their British boarding school. They shouted until they were hoarse, fought at the slightest provocation, and came to resemble two filthy little urchins with scabby knees and heads full of lice, replete with warm, freshly picked fruit, sun, and freedom. They left early in the morning and came home at sundown, spending their days hunting rabbits with their slingshots, riding horseback until they were worn out, and spying on the women who were washing clothes down by the river. And so 3 years went by, until the earthquake changed things. After that vacation, the twins returned to the city ahead of the rest of the family, accompanied by Nana, the city servants, and most of the baggage. The boys went straight to their boarding school, while Nana and the other employees readied the big house on the corner for the arrival of the owners. Blanca stayed behind in the country with her parents for a few more days. It was then that Clara began having nightmares, walking in her sleep, and waking up screaming. During the day, she went about half in a dream, seeing premonitions in the animals' behavior. The hens were not laying their daily eggs. The cows were acting frightened. The dogs were howling to death. The rats, spiders, and worms were coming out of their hiding places. The birds were leaving their nests and flying off in great formations, while her pigeons were screaming with hunger in the treetops. She stared obsessively at the frail column of white smoke that was issuing from the volcano and peered at the changes in the color of the sky. Blanca made her all sorts of soothing teas and warm baths, and Esteban resorted to the old box of homeopathic pills to calm her down. But her nightmares continued. There's going to be an earthquake, Clara announced, daily growing paler and more agitated.
For God's sake, Clara, there are always quakes, Esteban replied.